Hey friends, I'm Ashley.
Hey you guys,
I'm Lainey.
And this is Haunted Real Estate. Back to Haunted Real Estate, where we discuss spooky haunted history all over the world. I am Ashley.
And I am Lainey.
Thanks for popping in today. So I personally have always had this fascination with ghost towns, especially ones that are like really well preserved.
I do love a good ghost town.
Yeah.
How preserved are we talking?
Well, so some ghost towns, one that we're going to talk about today in particular, is very well preserved. So it basically looks like it's frozen in time.
That's so scary.
Which those are fascinating because then It just really like, it makes your imagination go wild, even though you might learn the story and understand what happened. If you were to just stumble upon a ghost town, you'd be like, why did everybody leave? Why are there still dishes out? Why are there like clothes here or shoes on the floor? You know, it's like everybody just literally disappeared is what it looks like.
Yeah, that's very ominous.
Yeah. So this might be a little bit of a series that we do where we just take a few episodes and just make them purely ghost towns because there's a lot in America and whole world. So Whole world of ghost towns.
We've got spooky roads. We've got triangles. And now we've got towns.
Yeah, tales of the triangles and ghost towns. So let's get to it. We have already done two ghost towns, technically, even though we didn't allocate those as specifically ghost town episodes. But Dudley Town was one that we did, which is not like your regular ghost town because you can't really tell the remnants of a town. But that one's a good one. And then we did St. Elmo, Colorado, which did have a creepy background of the family who decided to remain there and live out their life by themselves.
Yeah, super weird.
Which was, yeah, weird and creepy and left for some fun haunted history. Okay, so what is a ghost town? Basically, it's an abandoned town that was once usually like a bustling area. And it's usually due to some kind of economic issue, especially towns that are centered around one major economic.
I was just moving my microphone.
I was like doing it so slow, but I could hear it like slightly creak. So it might be due to like an economic reason. Like gold mining towns are perfect ghost towns because you run out of gold, everybody up and leaves, and they just leave everything there.
Yeah.
So that's one of the ghost towns we're going to talk about today. But sometimes it's a natural or human disaster that might cause people to leave. And sometimes these towns are left so perfectly untouched, they just remain frozen in time.
Can I ask real quick, what is a human disaster? I've never heard it.
A man-made disaster.
Okay.
So I don't know why I decided to say human disaster instead of man-made. Sorry.
Oh, that sounds awful.
Humans are disasters. Yes. So, but yeah, so we're going to talk about two ghost towns today. One is Bodie, and that is in Bodie, California. And the other one is in Centralia, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Both completely different situations and both equally fascinating, I think. So Bodie was a gold mining town in California. When I taught U.S. history, one of the first topics, because I taught it for 11th grade and in Texas, 11th grade basically starts at the end of Reconstruction / gold rush years.
Okay.
So anyway, it was one of the first things we always talked about in U.S. history, and I would always show them Bodie, California as a fun ghost town.
It's fun. You're a cool teacher. I wish my teacher did that for me.
Because it's just like, it's frozen in time. It's like, look at, like, when you think of the Wild West, like, Bodie, California is the Wild West.
Yeah.
So at the time, California wasn't even a state until gold was discovered, and gold is what interested the U.S. in taking over our Western states, and really, gold helped fulfill the manifest destiny.
That's so crazy. That's a huge part of our history.
I know it is. And that's why these like little things are such an amazing representation of like what was once. I felt like a lot of W's just sort of like what was once was.
Yes.
You know what I meant. I think. I'm not even sure what I meant. So California was aptly named the Golden State for the riches that lied beneath, and it led to the biggest migration in U.S. history, which is crazy to think how one commodity shaped our country that much.
Well, it's gold.
Yeah.
It's gold, baby.
It's gold.
But definitely changed the landscape of the West for sure. So back to Bodie. It was founded in 1859 when four prospectors came to the area in search of gold. Now remember, California Gold Rush was 1849, which is where we get the 49ers from. So this,
I actually did not know that.
Oh, well, there's a fun little side fact. That's how 49ers got their name, because 1849 is when everyone rushed to California, and only within a couple years did we adopt it as a state.
Wow, that is a fun fact.
Fun fact. So with Bodie, it's about 10 years later, 1859. Prospectors were still trying to find their big break. And honestly, prospectors were going from California, Oregon, Washington, and then we know the Klondike Gold Rush was Alaska. So they were just searching that whole entire area. You got a mountainous region, you may have some gold.
I'm just thinking of city slickers.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. That's all I'm thinking about. Those are the prospectors.
That's a modern day sort of prospector.
Yeah.
They didn't bring any of the right tools for the job, I don't think. Mm-hmm. And I think in both movies they end up getting robbed. At least in the second movie, I know they do.
Yeah.
So they have no tools. I love that movie. I love part two. So 10 years later, prospectors are still looking for their big break, and that's how they ended up in Bodie. But of these four prospectors, there was a guy named William Bodie was among them. So you can't tell when I'm speaking because you're not, you know, looking at captions. But he spelt it B-O-D-E-Y, which kind of looks like body. And some people did spell it B-O-D-Y also, so it really looks like body. But it later became spelt B-O-D-I-E due to an accidental misspelling, but people preferred it because it ended up being just pronounced more correctly, so it was fine.
So like the body was found in California and everyone was like, what body? And it was like, we met Bodie.
A Bodie was found. Yes. Okay, but oddly enough, William Bodie did get killed in a huge blizzard that hit the area, and that is how it was named, Bodie. So it was because a body was found.
That's quite the body
belonged to Bodie.
Okay.
So those miners stayed there for about 6 years. And in total, there ended up being about 7 miners for the first 5 to 6 years. And they sustained themselves on what they found, but it wasn't a lot. Like, they were barely sustaining themselves. They dug shaft and opened up mines. But after about 6 years, they thought they were about out of resources. And then in 1875, one of those mines ended up caving in, which led to Bodie's big gold discovery. Okay. So everything those prospectors wanted, they literally fell into it. Enough gold was discovered that now word really got spread that there was gold in Bodie. And many from San Francisco, especially because that was like the miner's hub, ended up coming to Bodie to mine for gold. Also, while there was a good amount of gold, I always think of prospectors like, how do you decide where you're going to go start looking? Like, what skills do you have to be like, I sense there's gold there, or else... How much time do you waste before you decide you're done looking for gold?
I always think of who determines who gets as much gold or who gets... Well, how do they figure out the allotment?
Well, and that's part of the problem is that in these areas... Like, it was the Wild West. I mean, there's
shooting,
killing each other, robbery, like nobody's business. And it was that's seriously dangerous.
People shoot each other for it.
Right? Like, if there was just a diamond mine, it would have to be like heavily secured because anybody can just go walk up to it. And back then, the U.S. didn't even own this land. So
interesting.
I mean, well, I take it back. Bodie was officially a part of the U.S. around this time, but initially it was not.
Yeah.
California wasn't. Alaska wasn't. I mean, all those became states because of the resources they had, which is just interesting to think about. I mean, had we not found gold in Alaska, would we even have Alaska?
I don't know.
That's this like really far away appendage to us.
Still want to go to Alaska.
No, 100%. Yeah. I want to go to Alaska. It looks magical.
Country, part of Canada.
It's essentially Canada. Let's be real. We just have part of Canada. I'm not trying to down the U.S., okay? I'm glad we have Alaska. Glad you guys are a part of the U.S. I'm just saying, locationally, geographically, it don't look like it's supposed to be a part of us.
Yeah.
But yeah, I always feel like mining is such a gamble because you're going to go there with like your picks and stuff like that. And you're like, how much are you going to spend? 4 hours, 8 hours, days, weeks, months, and hope that you find something. And if you don't, you're like, okay, found a bunch of dirt and rocks. And now I move on. Like, I just don't understand.
I don't have the patience for that.
Like, if you threw me and Casey back to 1849 and Casey was like, Ashley, we got to go to the West and we got to go search for gold. I'd be like, with what? What are we doing?
I smell a divorce.
Like, we're just going to sit there and I'll just hope to God you get it because because most miners did not strike it rich.
Yeah, I feel like I would give it like a day and be like, oh, fuck this, I'm out of here.
A day, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Like, how long do you give it before you just think? Because gold was accidentally found in California.
Yeah.
Like, it was, what's that shiny thing in that river over there? And it turned out to be gold. And that's the start of the gold rush in California.
How did they even know it was worth anything? Who put the worth on gold?
That's an even older question. Like, gold has been of value for a long time. I just don't think they suspect. I don't know all the history of gold. So please nobody quote me on this. But I think it was valuable at the time. They just didn't know it was there. Yeah. Because there were gold rushes before that. Or gold found in other places in the U.S. So, we know, like, ancient Egypt and stuff, like, they had gold. And so it's been of value for a very long time. But obviously, that pumped very easily into the U.S. economy. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, of course, you find gold in Bodie. There's going to be companies that come and they want to capitalize on that discovery. So, Standard Company in 1877 produced more than $784,000 in gold and silver, which today is over $18 million. So, like, there was a good amount there. Mm-hmm. But what happens when a major resource like that is discovered is it doesn't just attract miners. Of course, it attracts companies from all over the country who want to invest in the mines of Bodie. But because it grew so big so fast, in this very remote desert town, which is literally like the Wild West, it is the Wild West, you're going to have saloons and alcohol and, oh, these miners bring their kids. There need to be schools. There needs to be hotels, lodging. You also need to entertain them. So there are sex workers and then people get rowdy. So now you need a jail. So it quickly developed into this little town. And it fascinates me how one discovery like that has this domino effect and just like, boom, nothing was here, nothing was interesting about this area until mm-hmm. gold was discovered. And now there's a it got up to a population of 10,000.
That's insane.
Which is pretty huge. It's actually bigger than the Pennsylvania town we're going to talk about. So with all these saloons and brawls and gunfights, there's lawlessness, a lot of lawlessness going on mm-hmm. In this area. So it's probably exactly what you think of when you think of the Wild West. Law enforcement was hardly present in the area. So naturally, it attracts some of the most colorful people of the time. So I actually have a little Wild West story to go along with it.
Ooh, exciting.
And it really just kind of paints the landscape of the time more than anything else. So when you think of the Wild West, you probably think like train robberies, shootouts, warm whiskey, which I often think about how the fact there was no refrigeration back in the day.
Yeah, that just sounds disgusting.
Yeah, doesn't it?
I love whiskey, but
warm, but in the desert, nope.
No.
So Bodie was no exception. It was a remote desert town, and that gold had to be transported to some of the major ports like San Francisco. Wells Fargo was a company that you would often use, and you probably know it well today as...
My bank.
Your bank. Yes, your bank. I also have a account there. So it was started by two businessmen, Henry Wells and William Fargo. They saw the gold discovery as a great opportunity, and their two major goals of the time were transportation and banking. So, fun side note, they also helped found American Express in 1850.
Interesting.
So at the time, California had very few railroads, so their plan was to create a service to provide to miners to safely take their gold, silver, and other valuables to whatever destination. So their first office was in San Francisco, which basically acted, like I said, as a hub for miners. A lot of gold was transported into San Francisco from wherever it was found.
I would have loved to see the old Wells Fargo building. Nope, you said San Francisco. I did not go there, but that would be so fun to see the old Wells Fargo building.
I have no idea where your train of thought just went.
Sorry, I was saying like the first Starbucks in Seattle.
Yeah, we did see that.
It would be cool to see the original Wells Fargo if it's still standing.
If it's still standing, I have no idea.
I mean, I'm not that married to my bank. Like, I must see it, but
yeah,
that would be cool.
Well, Wells Fargo was faster and cheaper than the U.S. Postal Service, so it was heavily utilized at the time. So those famous stagecoaches you see from Wild West movies were often being operated by Wells Fargo. And interesting, and I'll explain in a minute why he was a pretty interesting character. A well-known outlaw at the time, Milton Sharp, robbed these Wells Fargo stagecoaches. Who was an interesting fella? He was said to be very polite when he robbed people, which...
Sorry. Aww. That makes me think of, what is the movie I told you I watched recently? You hadn't seen it in a while. It has, oh my gosh.
Yeah, we just talked about this. What the heck?
But that's how she robs stores, because she learned from the guy that he does it very politely from Brad Pitt.
Wait, what movie? Now I don't know what we're talking about.
It's the two girls, they drive off the
cliff. Thelma and Louise.
Yes, that one.
Yeah, okay.
But the guy, when Brad Pitt robs, he talks about how he does it very politely and doesn't hurt anyone.
That works out for him.
That's what she does.
It's exactly Milton Sharp. He's very polite and he doesn't, I don't know him, but he doesn't ever hurt anybody. So I assume he's intentionally trying not to.
Yeah.
Which is just funny because robbing is like such a violation that it is offensive, but then you're trying to make it like disarm people by being polite about it.
I know. I wonder if the people were left penniless and just like, oh, but he was such a gentleman. Yes, you're right. He was.
Yeah. Well, that's what it was. People had a really hard time on like how to report him because he was a nice about it.
Yeah.
That polite demeanor just confused people. So Sharp met up with a new partner named W.C. Bill Jones, which sounds so Wild West. Like you can see that on a wanted poster.
I just see John C. Reilly in Wild West outfit.
Okay. Different. So they met in Bodie, California to plan their next robbery. So they stole $88 from the Wells Fargo Express. But in their next robbery, the one that we're going to talk about here, they stole over $15,000.
Holy moly.
Which I meant to look up how much that was for this time. I did other conversions and I forgot to convert that.
It's probably $1 million or close to it.
Yeah, it might be. You can look it up if you want to look it up on your phone and then tell me.
So 15,000?
15,000 in the 1870s to 2024. So Jones and Sharp robbed at least 6 stagecoaches that we know of in about 4 months. So their picture started spreading around and law enforcement was seriously on the hunt for them. Like there were bounty hunters and all sorts of people after them. So Sharp's politeness obviously made him stand out. His partner, Jones, was a bearded grizzly guy and very intimidating and not so polite. Well, like I said, Sharp was not only polite, but he was also very well-dressed. Like, he would rob people in a suit most of the time. And he was even polite to the Wells Fargo's guards when he'd ask them to hand over the strong box.
What's the strong box?
Like, where they'd lock up the money.
Oh, okay.
How much is $15,000?
$374,000.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. Yeah. Not bad for one trip.
Yeah.
So, one robbery, he was quoted saying, "A thousand pardons for the inconvenience I've caused you, but you see, these are the hazards of my profession. We must relieve you of your valuables."
Relieve you.
I must relieve you of your valuables. And for some reason, when I had read that quote, I imagined Hugh Grant saying it. So that was a weird.
Yeah.
It was a weird image in my mind. So yeah, that's how he would rob people. He would say something like that. So stories were also reported that if a woman cried enough, he would actually just give her back her belongings.
Oh, I would totally be great at this.
You'd be great at this, like you'd be crying like a baby.
Yes. Just, oh no.
The therapy I'm going to need after this.
Yes.
And he hands it all back to you. So when he left, he would even bow and thank everybody and then just go off into the night. And rarely did anybody ever get hurt under a Milton Sharp robbery. That is until one night, September 5th, 1880. Sharp, Jones, and another outlaw named, I think his name is Doe, D-O-W, but I also want to pronounce it Dow, but I'm going to say Doe. They stopped a Wells Fargo stagecoach that was taking gold from Bodie to Carson City. So Jones, the other grizzly man, fired a shot at the stagecoach, which actually killed one of the two horses.
No!
Yeah. So literally the dead weight like stopped them from being able to move forward.
So rude.
Can we also just take a minute here to think about these stagecoach guards who had to go riding with these valuables?
Yeah. That's a
there is not enough money in the world to cover the anxiety I would feel because they probably did a lot of traveling at night, so yeah. They were less visible.
I'd always be looking over my shoulder. Like,
oh my God, I know. Like one
faster.
One stick crack, I'd be like, oh my God, that's it. Like I'm dead. Like no, there's just no way.
They had to have guns and.
Oh yeah, they did.
Burly men, I hope.
Yeah, they definitely had weapons and stuff, but. In this scenario, you freaking killed a horse. So now you're stuck in the desert, no cell phone. Just, yeah. What are you going to do? So anyway, the Wells Fargo stagecoach, I'll tell you what he did. He fired back. And he shot the third guy, Doe, that they were with, that third outlaw that was with them. So he was killed and his body was left there. And then they stole that $15,000 in gold, which then led to posters being spread everywhere of Milton Sharp and Jones. Now, like I said, Milton was pretty easy to identify due to what he wore when robbing and his politeness. So it was pretty easy to be like, yeah, that's the guy that y'all are talking about on the posters. And the reward for their capture was $3,000, which at the time was, see, I did this conversion, $72,000. So it was a $72,000 in today's money reward for their capture.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
So that's the real gold right there. Go freaking find these guys that are robbing. Like, there's just so many money-making opportunities with the gold rush. And yeah. I didn't even mention it, but like the people who bring the resources to, like Levi Strauss got his start during the gold rush because he invented jeans. Like,
what did they wear before, do you think?
Clothes that got torn up, like cotton and stuff like that. And it is not a good material to be like working in mines and in the rivers and stuff. Wow. And that's where Levi Strauss got his start with his very durable canvas-like material.
That's very cool.
Like, there was a lot of money-making opportunities outside of being a prospector. It was crazy. So this was a huge, hefty reward, which, like I said, bounty hunters, law enforcement, and random people with a gun went out on a hunt for these guys. So Sharp ended up being captured in San Francisco, where he was then extradited to Nevada to face 6 robbery charges against Wells Fargo. Under questioning, Sharp stayed silent as to where his loot went, because he did not speak of where all the money from these 6 robberies went. But supposedly, he went to bury it. And a lot of it was gold. They're not talking like cash here.
Yeah.
And under intense questioning, he never responded where those valuables were hidden. So one night, November 1880, a guard went to go make sure Sharp was tucked in asleep, and he was gone. Totally vanished with a 15-pound iron ball chained to him.
Oh.
So quite the escape artist.
Absolutely.
He kind of made the perfect escape, except like any prisoner that escapes, I think they only think about the escape. They don't think about what happens when you escape.
Yeah.
He had a 15-pound ball attached to him and no food, no money, no resources. So he didn't stay hidden that long. They did raise the reward to $5,000 for his capture. So now we're into hundreds of thousands of dollars in today's money. So he really could not hide. The hunt was aggressive. And like I said, he had no resources, but the reward was not claimed because he did end up turning himself in. So he couldn't hide. And he was like, I'm going to die out here or I have to turn myself in. So that's what he did. He ended up getting 20 years in prison in Carson City. He tried and failed again to escape, but then eventually decided to chill out and just be a model prisoner and hope for his release. But when he had his first hearing, which was only about a year into his sentence, he was denied his pardon. So then he went back to trying to escape. And in 1889, he did escape and was not seen or heard from for 4 years.
Four.
Okay. So while he was on his prison vacation, he did actually get a job. And when he was recaptured October 3rd, 1893, he was sent back to prison. He wrote a letter to Wells Fargo explaining during his time away from prison that he was working honestly and had truly been rehabilitated. And what's kind of fascinating is that they agreed with him. Even though he escaped from prison, that for 4 years he was not up to no good, like supposedly he did get an honest job, Wells Fargo actually recommended that they pardon him and let him go out into the real world, and he was released 9 months after sending that letter.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So
that would never happen today.
No, it wouldn't. And what's even more kind of awesome is that he did go on to lead like a fairly normal life, like got a job. No longer did anybody know anyway that if he was robbing, I mean, I don't think he was. He was on the straight and narrow, but he never said where his valuables were hidden. And I don't think he lived a super lavish lifestyle. So nobody thinks he went and got it. Some parts of it have been found, but they think 70% of those valuables have not been recovered.
That's it. Wow.
So some have looked for Sharp's treasure, and it's supposedly hidden. Basically, it would have likely been hidden where the old stagecoach road. Oh my God, almost said stage roaches because I was trying to say stagecoach roads. Those stage roads. I'll just say that it would be along one of those. So somewhere between Aurora, Nevada, and Bodie, California, it's believed that the valuables he stole are buried somewhere around there.
Wow.
So you'd be out in a pretty desolate area to go look for it, but it might be there.
Just pull off the side of the road in Nevada and start digging.
Yeah. Again, it's just like looking for gold. Where do you start? How do you know?
Yeah, they didn't have any kind of detectors at the time. Mm-hmm. So that's crazy.
Yeah. So back to Bodie. I just really wanted to throw in a little outlaw story. So like I said, lots of new residents came into Bodie, and this is a Wild West town, and the population ended up growing upwards of 10,000 people, which is crazy big. But like many of our ghost towns, this one started declining once the gold, or at least the more easily accessible gold, started to deplete. Once the mines run out and you've lost your major economic boom that you had, I mean, that was like the one commodity it was all circled around, the people started to trickle out. So people started leaving in the late 1880s, and by the 1940s, it was completely deserted. So the first major company to invest in Bodie was Standard Company. They left Bodie in 1913. So when the town's wealthiest investors leave, that's not a good sign for what's to come. And yeah, it doesn't give a lot of people hope that are there that they'll continue to have jobs and stuff like that. So
where is Bodie, California? Like, it's, I guess it's not on the water or anything.
No, it's close to Nevada. It's on the east side of California. Okay. So it's in that desert area of between Nevada and California.
Okay. So not ideal to live in.
No. Definitely not. So by the time World War II started, the town was truly abandoned and population literally went to zero. Not like some of the other towns we've talked about where, so this one did have some stragglers for a while. And I think that's any ghost town. Like, it's not going to be thousands to zero unless mm-hmm. it's like some major crazy disaster. This one ended up having a small number for a while, but it ultimately went down to zero. But when people decided to leave due to its remoteness, they literally packed up whatever they could carry and then left, which is what makes it special today, because they had to leave a lot of things there. And so yeah, it looks like it's frozen in time. So 1962, Bodie became a state park for California and was declared in arrested decay, which basically means that the government has to preserve the ruins. So it, again, unless like a major storm comes and knocks everything down, they're supposed to be maintaining it so it doesn't just like fall apart.
That's so crazy that the government even cares. I mean, that's awesome that they do.
It's awesome.
Just, it's weird that they care about this town from the 1800s.
Yeah.
Surprised any of it's still standing.
110 structures still remain.
That's some great craftsmanship.
It's great craftsmanship. They are maintaining it, though. It's not like it's been untouched.
Yeah.
It looks untouched, but they have had to maintain it. So, you know, if there are big storms and stuff like that that come in, they do have to do repairs and things like that.
What kind of storms does Nevada and that area have?
Well, Bodie died in a blizzard.
Oh.
So, I mean, it is a desert, so I mean, yeah, deserts do have storms, just not usually like rainstorms like we have. But it's literally one of America's best preserved ghost towns. Here's a little bit of the creepy part of Bodie, though. There is a known legend called the Bodie Curse. If you take anything from the town, you will be marred with bad luck. Park rangers have actually reported items getting mailed to them later with a letter explaining that the mailer, that whoever mailed it, took the item and had nothing but bad luck ever since. And so they are returning it in hopes to go back to a normal life.
Wow.
So please don't steal while you're there. Even so much as taking a rock from Bodie can curse you. So unless you want misfortune to befall you, Bodie is a look, don't touch kind of place.
Got it.
Unless you buy something from a souvenir shop, which then you should be fine. So I highly encourage you to go right now, unless you're driving, to look at pictures of Bodie, because it is the most pristine, beautiful ghost town I think you'll ever see. I mean, like I said, I used to show students pictures when I taught the Gold Rush because it's just an amazing encapsulation of the time period.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Here, I'll show you pictures real quick because, you know, I saved some.
Wow.
Isn't it like perfect Old West?
Yeah. It's,
and like even a kitchen that was okay. That's going into the next ghost town.
Yeah, that looks cool.
It's so pretty.
It is.
Anyway, I want to visit. See you soon, Bodie. Okay, so the next town is a wee bit creepier.
All right.
So this one is Centralia, Pennsylvania, which was the inspiration behind Silent Hill.
Oh.
If you've played the video game or you watch the movie, it's an incredibly eerie setting. Uh-huh. And this is where they literally said that this town was its inspiration behind that.
Aren't you in like kind of a different dimension in Silent Hill?
Yeah, Silent Hill does have different dimensions. But so there has been an underground fire blazing because it's a mining town and it's a coal mining town, not a gold mining town. Mm-hmm. I just realized that I did two mining towns. That's funny. I didn't make, because it was two different things. So I wasn't thinking of them both being mining, but this is coal, which coal is flammable. Mm. So yeah, there's been a fire burning underneath it since 1962, and it is still ablaze today.
Wow.
And it's predicted to burn for another 250 years.
Holy moly.
Yeah. So the scene for Silent Hill is very gray and eerie, which is kind of how it looks, but this is not like Bodhi. This wasn't due to an economic collapse. This was a man-made disaster. And because the fire is underneath the ground, they've had to knock down most of the building. So you're not going to get a pristine ghost town.
Yeah.
The buildings are unsafe to be in.
Yeah.
Because they have either collapsed over the years or whatever. But the town has been mostly evacuated. So let's start at the beginning here. Coal and mining started as the primary economic foothold in the area in about the 1830s. The land was originally called Bull's Head. So once it was purchased by a mining company, they platted the land and then they tried renaming it to Centerville, Pennsylvania. As it turns out, there already was a Centerville, Pennsylvania, so they named it Centralia.
Centralia,
which became an officially incorporated city in 1866. So Centralia did become a pretty bustling town by the end of the 1800s. They had over 24 saloons, multiple hotels. They had a couple of churches, but the main church was St. Ignatius, which had over 3,000 members. In 1908, there was a pretty devastating fire. 150 of the residents of Centralia did become homeless after the fire, and 40 of its buildings were burnt down. So that was 1808. They rebuilt it. They were resilient. What sucks is we know that World War I was not far behind. World War I started in 1914. So there wasn't much of a gap between this fire happening and World War I. And by the time the U.S. entered, it started to affect the mining industry pretty heavily, as most miners were men and many men went to war. Mm-hmm. So post-World War I, there was another major thing that happened worldwide, and that was a major flu outbreak. There was a devastating outbreak, and in Centralia specifically, it did kill 10% of their population.
Oh, wow.
So literally imagine one out of every 10 people you knew dying of the flu. Like, that's pretty scary. So there wasn't a person in town that was not affected by the flu. So then after that, you have the next major historical event, which was the Great Depression.
Yeah.
Which was greatly depressing.
Yes.
That obviously created a massive economic hardship to the people. But don't worry, the next major thing that happened in the U.S. pulled them right out of the Depression, and that was World War II.
Oh, great. This is just a wonderful story.
So what? It's honestly sad. I'm not saying the town's cursed. That's totally me just making that up. But it's like, damn, a lot of things some of these things were completely outside its control. The flu, the World Wars, the Great Depression, that has nothing specifically due to Centralia, but it just sucks that all these things are happening in the U.S.
It's just a bad time to be alive, honestly.
Yeah. Between 1908, Centralia's major fire, and 1945, the end of World War II, the town honestly could not catch a break for that almost 40-year time period. But here's another weird thing that happened. In 1948, so the last 40 years, there was a plane crash right near Centralia. Flight 624, flying from DC to New York, crashed just north of Centralia, killing 43 passengers on board.
Do you know how many passengers were on board in total?
I think that was all of them.
Oh, okay.
So this time in the town's history was very sad. But now let's get to how it started to become a ghost town. Because spoiler alert, most everyone ends up dipping out of Centralia. Most everyone.
Okay.
So not much notable happened between 1948 through the 1950s. They went back to being a peaceful, albeit pretty small community. Come 1962, though, Memorial Day weekend, the town was planning for a big celebration. May 27th, it was time to clear out some trash in anticipation for the festivities of the weekend. So they did this yearly to eliminate odors and help get rid of waste. Pennsylvania had actually changed their laws on how to get rid of waste during the 1950s, which made it more complicated to get rid of trash. So there were several illegal dumping sites in the area. Specifically, Centralia had 8 illegal dump sites. So what they did was they were like, let's consolidate the 8 illegal dump sites. We'll take this old mining pit, which it was approximately 50 feet deep, and they made that the new dump site. So they consolidated all the trash and they put it in that one dump site. And so they started a fire May 27th, 1962. It was a controlled burned by the fire department, and it was extinguished by the nighttime. All seemed fine.
So they thought.
2 days after that, the flames returned and the fire department rushed to the scene to put it out. Again, it was extinguished. Or so they thought. A week later, the flames reignited again. A freaking week later.
Yeah.
Every time they thought they put it out. So they brought in a crew, they mixed up the trash, and they were like, it must be something at the bottom that's just very flammable that just keeps like having some cinders. Embers. I'm like, cinders? What's that way? Yeah, some embers. So they mixed up the trash to get to the bottom of the pit and extinguish whatever it was that kept reigniting. As they were turning over the trash, they realized that this was not a closed off pit. It actually was an opening to an old mining vein or a coal mining vein, which essentially it was just a pathway underground to more coal mines, multiple coal mines. So they call them coal veins, but they're literally just pathways to different mines.
Yeah.
And so this fire was underground. They unknowingly had lit an old coal mine on fire and it linked to many more mines.
Oh, that's so scary.
So these coal mines dated all the way back to the 1850s. So over 100 years of mining veins underneath the ground. Mm-hmm. And like I said, coal is flammable. So it lights and it'll burn for a long time. So an underground fire had ignited that would prove pretty much impossible to stop. Now, some of that, this was obviously man-made. They set the trash on fire, but then their handling of it did not help anything. Mm-hmm. So over 2 months went by that they tried putting out this fire to no avail. So towards the end of summer 1962, so this fire has been going on all summer underground. The town convened to discuss what the next steps would be because they waited 2 months to like, hey, yeah, we can't do this. Let's figure it out. But the problem is that you're not going to follow a fire underground. I mean, it's essentially underground caves. There's just no way to see how far this fire has spread. And that's what's made this so complicated.
That's so scary to think about. Like, the walls are made of coal. Like, the whole thing is on fire. That's...
Yeah, and it burns pretty... on the slower side, it burns, and for a long time.
I used to charcoal grill all the time.
Yeah.
It's slow.
So the town convened and said, okay, what are the next steps? What was kind of shady here as the council to the townspeople told them that the fire started from unknown origins. They did not want to say that we had a control burn to get rid of trash. I mean, and in 1962, that was, I think, pretty acceptable. It's pretty much how a lot of people got rid of trash. So I don't understand why they didn't just say that. They said they didn't know how it started. I guess they really just wanted to go ahead and remove themselves from what happened. But anyway, we know that that's not how it happened. We do know how it happened. So outside of using a mining pit, which wasn't the best plan, the fire department tried doing this responsibly. They did. One engineer said he could put out the fire for $175. One miner said that he could put it out if he could keep the coal. Both of these plans were rejected in favor of an excavation company that charged $20,000, which today is over $200,000, to put out the fire. And I'm not saying any of these plans, one was right or one wasn't. Like, could one guy have stopped it that was a miner? I don't know. How well does he know these mines to put out a fire? The engineer, I have no idea. The excavation company also wasn't a bad idea, except the town's leadership limited the excavation company to only allowing them to part of the area to battle the flames. They wouldn't let the excavation company survey the area or do any kind of planning to come up with a best course of action. What's the
point of getting them then?
I don't know. Like, you got them.
Do what they do.
Well, then on top of that, they said you can only work weekdays and you can only work 8 hours a day. But I don't know if y'all know this, but fires actually will go 24 hours a day.
What?
Not just weekdays, 8 hours a day. So every minute they weren't working, the fire just continued to spread.
Yeah.
So they literally never were going to be able to keep up with it, unfortunately, because there was more time not fighting the fire than there was fighting the fire. So project funds ran out by October and the fire was continuously spreading underneath them going towards the town. So while their fates were being sealed, the townspeople were not being told the gravity of the situation. I mean, I don't even know if the town council knew the gravity of the situation. Like, it's a fire underneath your feet. It's not spreading building to building. Mm-hmm. So this isn't like the same kind of issue. So they had no idea this underground fire was coming their direction and what danger it posed to them. So
this reminds me of like Dante's Peak when the town realizes it's going off. Like, ugh.
Yeah, too late.
Yeah.
So unrelated to the fire, the railroad stopped coming to Centralia in 1967, which if anything, it's not a great sign when one of the major forms of transportation is no longer coming to the area. Mm-hmm. So then the Department of Interior, so the U.S. government, finally had to get involved around this time, and at least 5 years, and they're coming in 5 years after the fire started at this point to see what they can do to put it out. But it had gone on far too long, and it was 225 feet underground. So there's like no way to get like really solve this problem anymore at this point. It maybe was solvable in the summer of 1962, but come 1967, you don't even know where the fire is anymore.
Yeah.
There was no feasible way to put it out. So residents were starting to get sick, like literally sick, not just sick of the problem, but sick because the air quality started changing in Centralia.
Oh, yeah. I don't think you can breathe in charcoal fire.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide poisoning. So fire wasn't able to be contained, even though both the local and national government were now involved in just trying to throw money at the problem. But the townspeople started to split into two different schools of thought. Some wanted the government to keep trying to fix the problem, and there were some ready to move away. But the problem is that it's hard in good conscience to sell your house in an area you know is on probably an inevitable forever decline. So even though you might want to leave, you might not have the option to leave unless the government helps buy you out of this problem.
Yeah.
So some people wanted the government to buy them out and take eminent domain and pay for their houses, and then they could leave. And then others wanted the government to fight it. This has been their hometown for years and years. They didn't want to leave.
That's so sad.
It is.
There's so many idiots that are just making poor decisions.
But those that wanted it fixed, it would amount to over $660 million to fix it. And that's 1960s prices. That's not even converted to 2024 prices. Converted today to 2024, that's over $2 billion for this small town to hopefully save it. No guarantees.
Yeah.
Can you imagine being like townspeople? It'll cost $2 billion. No guarantee. Your taxes will skyrocket. You good with that?
Yeah.
Probably not. So November 21st, 1979, John Coddington's gas station in Centralia, he noticed there was steam rising from the ground. And he was like, that's weird.
Gas and fire don't mix.
Well, it was coming from the ground, which it was the fire underground causing steam to come up.
Yeah.
So 2 days later, steam was rising. He went back to go check the temperature because why would there be steam rising? And the steam was 120 degrees. So it was toasty. And within the next week or so, John Coddington noticed steam rising from his basement floors. Like, he lived at the gas station.
Oh, that's so scary.
And the temperatures read 136 degrees. And so both the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Resources and the Pennsylvania Police Fire Marshal were called. So now if you're a gas station owner, there's an obvious concern, right? Gas and fire, like you said. Gas is flammable and combustible. So on orders of the fire marshal, the owner had to empty the tanks. They filled it with water and he had to abandon the property. What's even more unfortunate is that this was the town's only gas station.
Aww.
So now it's like, one, this guy just lost his entire livelihood. And two, the townspeople would have to leave town to go get gas. So again, not looking good for the future for the town. The building ended up having to be demolished in 1981. And it was the first official casualty after nearly 20 years of the fire starting.
Wow.
So the tiniest bit of silver lining here is due to the ground being so hot, people didn't have to shovel snow anymore off the sidewalks and driveways.
Oh, that's a win.
And you know it gets pretty chilly in Pennsylvania, so at least the ground was warm enough to not keep the snow there.
Yeah.
So there was that, but really the ground was getting hotter, which was just an indication that things were getting worse under the ground. And then on top of that, trees were starting to die. So, and some of the trees literally just turned to ash. Sidewalks and roads began to buckle, and the ground literally could not hold itself anymore. So you can kind of see how the setting is starting for Silent Hill.
Yeah.
You have these cracks starting. You have steam coming up off the ground. You have trees and plants dying. Later in 1981, the government built several ventilation shafts that would literally be a blazing hot pipe coming from the ground to release and vent out gases from underneath. And then they had a tiny chain link fence around it that said, don't touch.
Yeah, that's what people are supposed to breathe in.
Yeah.
Oh.
At the very least, it stunk up the town. But that wasn't the worst of it. The town actually began taking on more blows from the underground fire. So poisonous gases were now being released into the air. And depending on where people lived, some were suffering very seriously from the effects of the gas. People would literally faint in their homes due to gas just being emitted. A lot of physical ailments like body aches, headaches, vomiting, dizziness were becoming more of a commonplace. But in more severe cases, people were confused. They couldn't think straight. And in extreme cases, carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide poisoning can lead to convulsions, coma, or death.
That's insane that this is the 1980s and it's This is, why isn't everybody gone?
I think we cannot place a value on our homes, like in the sense that like your hometown. But when I was like talking to Casey about this, because like when I research these things, obviously it puts my mind in a different state. And I was like, I'm like, you know, I love Cypress, Texas. I've been here since I was 2 years old. Like, this is my home. But if there's a major event like this where everybody's leaving, I'm not even about to be in my own neighborhood by myself. Like, yeah. I love it here, but I don't love it that much. I would be like, yeah, we're leaving. I just, why?
You care more about your children and husband's safety than you do about your own or the house.
Right. Like, it is a safety issue. But every time I read stories like this, because it's just like, why did you stay? You know, we did that with St. Elmo, Bodie. Yeah. Some people straggled for a long time. And then stuff like this. I mean, you're just like, people just love their homes. And it's hard to place a value on that, especially if you've been there for decades and decades, or you have, you know, like your second, third, fourth generation living there.
Yeah.
I can imagine that's difficult. I mean, it's not like generations of our family live in Cypress. You're talking Houston, sure, but like,
yeah,
Texas, we have a long generation in Texas, but not specifically here. So I don't feel like our roots are so deep. But Valentine's Day, February 14th, 1981. After so many health complaints and scares, the government decided to run tests for the air quality and see how severe the situation was becoming. Well, it was severe, not just because of the air quality, but there was another event that was a wake-up call to the town. A little boy named Todd Domboski was playing in his grandmother's backyard when he noticed steam rising from the ground, and he went to go investigate it.
How old is he?
I believe he was 12. Yeah, so he went to go investigate that steam, and all of a sudden, the ground literally fell out from under him, and thank God he had quick reflexes. He grabbed onto a tree root while the steam was shooting up. Some of the steam measured as much as 350 degrees Fahrenheit.
Being in an oven.
Finally, his cousin noticed him and went to go pull him from the tree root to safety. So he did end up being okay. But the hole,
burns.
Yeah, I'm sure he had some burns, and the hole was approximately 150 feet deep.
Holy moly.
And this was the first of many sinkholes that began to happen in Centralia, which again, major safety concern, because you don't know like what's happening to the ground underneath you. So literally the ground was no longer safe to walk on. It was all being compromised by the fire. So thank God little Todd survived. But like I said, it was a major wake-up call for the area, and things were becoming far worse than anyone imagined. Because again, it's underground. You can't see it. So it's hard to know how serious this is. So at this point, they pretty much deemed Centralia was no longer a safe place to live.
Oh, finally.
So the government put together a fund to buy people out of their home.
Thank God.
But that's the unfortunate aspect of these environmental disasters. Not everybody can pack up their family and leave. And their entire lives were in that town. Their money was invested into their homes. And the government put a fund together of $42 million to buy out the residents of the town. But it wasn't handled exactly right. People were not getting what they needed to walk away from their homes. In one particular case in the 1980s, on one family's home was valued at $43,000. They had a mortgage on it, and the government offered them $17,000 to leave.
Oh, wow.
And so you're stuck. What an impossible choice.
Yeah.
I mean, on paper, yes, safety is more important than anything else. You leave. But if you do that, you have to understand that you're now upside down. You still have to figure out, how are you paying this mortgage for a home you don't live in? Do you even have money to live somewhere else?
Yeah.
I mean, those are serious questions people had to ask themselves, that they might be underwater. So if their offers were not accepted, meaning if you did not accept what the government was offering you for your home, they were pretty much told by the government this was their only option, that no more money was going to be put into trying to put out this fire. They weren't necessarily going to be there to help or save anybody if anything happened. So people were forced to either take pennies on the dollar or stay in their house, which the government didn't want anyone staying in their house. They wanted everybody to take the offer, but they knew the offers weren't super great. Mm-hmm. So those that didn't take the offer slowly began to get evicted from their homes through eminent domain, which was officially implemented in 1993. So the government even made it so you could not leave your property in Centralia to your heirs. So they deem this so unsafe that nobody can own it after you. Literally an impossible position for the poor residents of Centralia.
So sad. And I can't believe I was already born and 3 years old at this time.
Yeah. So by 1993, 63 residents remained. So those residents did not have it easy. They fought legal battles to stay in their homes. And June 25th, 1995, the major church, St. Ignatius, had their final service before closing their doors, and it was torn down November 1997. And by 2009, the fire went past the boundary lines of Centralia. While no one was directly killed by the underground fire, many people developed major health issues due to the gases being released that did cost lives. In 2013, less than 10 residents remained in Centralia. They did win the legal battle, and they were awarded $349,500, and they were allowed to stay in their home, but Pennsylvania did still say that they were not allowed to leave their homes to anybody. They wanted the town cleared by the time these people passed away. So literally Pennsylvania's plan would be to seize whatever remaining structures are there and most likely demolish them.
So when it went past the town, where did it go?
Some of it went to another town actually called Burnsville. And it's, and again, you can't see spelling. Burn is B-Y-R-N. It's named after the Burns family. It's not burning like a fire.
I went to another town called Burnsville.
Yeah, so this neighboring town, Burnsville, named after the Burns family, literally unrelated to the fire. It was also a mining town and also became a ghost town decades after the fire. It suffered much of the same fate as Centralia, except it was just a smaller town, so it's not as well known. Other towns neighboring the area are at risk now of the fire spreading.
What direction is it going? Like what neighboring
right.
state, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Anywhere it can spread within the mines. So that's the problem. And so like if you are a mining town or you're living on top of these mines, you're at risk.
Okay. Wow. This is going to go on way past our expiration date. That's insane.
Yep. So Burnsville, like I said, it's a much smaller town. Centralia today has one functioning building left, and it's the Ukrainian Catholic Church called the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary Church. Everything else has been abandoned or torn down. There are, according to the May 2024, so this year's census, there are 5 residents that remain in Centralia. I kind of skipped around on my notes here. Nature has also reclaimed most of the town, so it would be unrecognizable to a lot of its past residents because it's not like Bodie where they've preserved it. They've actually had to knock it down due to safety. So streets have been overgrown with vegetation. You can't even see some of the old roads. Many buildings were torn down in the 80s and 90s. Sinkholes have formed. It's very unsafe. Highway 61, which was the major road that went through the town, was deemed unsafe. That part of the road was never utilized again as a functioning road, so they had to divert it to go around the town. But that road became known as Graffiti Highway because everybody wanted to go visit that main road and they graffitied all over it, but it started getting major cracks and sinkholes. And so they actually went and put in 2020, they took dump trucks and filled it full of dirt mounds so that people could not go on that old highway anymore.
Yeah.
They wanted to prevent them from, it wasn't even the graffiti that was an issue because you're basically talking about an abandoned town, but it was their safety that people put their safety at risk to go visit some of these areas.
Yeah.
So like I said, there's one functioning building, the Ukrainian Catholic Church. It sits atop a hill. It's not directly being impacted by the underground fire. And it's actually been around since 1912. So it's over 100 years old and still holding strong. And like we said, Centralia has enough coal underneath the ground to burn for another 250 years.
Wow.
And in 2006, it became the setting to the creepy horror movie Silent Hill. So the constant steam rising from the ground definitely gives Centralia a spooky landscape. There are only traces of what once was. And like I said, what's different about this town from a place like Bodie is due to the ground buckling and safety issues, most of the buildings are having to be torn down. So you're not going to see all the same kind of abandoned buildings. There are areas around Centralia that are just pass-through roads, and a lot of people may not have any idea the history mm-hmm. of the town they're driving through. But officially, and this is an eerie thought, Centralia has more people buried in its cemeteries than living.
Wow.
And that is really something to make you think about this place being haunted.
Yeah.
So they're the last remaining residents will be permanently etched into the town's history. So FYI, like we said, if you enjoyed this ghost town episode, go and listen to our Dudley Town or St. Elmo, Colorado episode. I think these are really fun to talk about and how they came to be.
Yeah, they so, were fun.
That's about all, folks.
Well, thank you very much. That was enjoyable.
So if you guys would like to donate to the show, our Venmo is at HauntedRE. Make sure you send us a property you'd like us to cover, but I do want to go ahead and put a disclaimer that there are no promises because some people have given us stuff to research that is not easily researchable because it's very local. So I don't want to promise anything. So if you just have something you want us to research or look into, we'd be happy to do it. I just can't promise it's going to be on the show, but we really do try our best to do that. And if you'd like to just send a recommendation, same goes, no guarantees, but we'd love for you to send us a recommendation or an interesting real estate story. If you lived in a haunted house, moved in a haunted house, went to a creepy showing, because as a real estate agent, I see a lot of weird stuff. I'd like to know that story too. You can email us at hauntedrepod@gmail.com and or go follow us on Instagram at haunted.real.estate. And please, if you have not, go rate and review us on your preferred podcast platform. It helps us get more listeners like you, so they hopefully know we don't suck.
Yeah.
Unless you're there to say we do suck, in which case.
You suck too.
You suck too. So that's it. Definitely go look up pictures. We will post it on Instagram. Oh, here's one of the pictures I was going to show you of the road splitting and steam coming up. Oh. It's just like so weird to look at. And then that's a ventilation. Look at that sad fence covering. Like, how is that stopping a child from going to touch that?
Yeah, that is some weak shit right there.
Yeah. And that's John Coddington's gas station that became the first official casualty of the fire.
That's so sad.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, friends, for listening. And we are going to have 2 weeks in a row, I think, of episodes because we're recording again right after this. So yay.
Woohoo.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.